just things for me.
Hello, podcast legends. My name is Ben Greenwood. I am the off-road performance coach. This podcast is to share with you how we do things at Race Ready Off-Road Coaching. So if you want to be a beast on and off the dirt bike, you have certainly come to the right place. It's April already. Holy cow. This year is flying by. So we are on to another listener Q&A podcast episode for the month of April. Had some great questions sent in actually this month. So thank you to everyone who has sent the questions in. We've got a bit of training stuff, a little bit of nutrition stuff, and a little bit of riding technique stuff as well. So a good little range of questions here that I am sure a lot of you will get some value out of. So question number one came off good old Instagram. This particular gentleman had suffered himself a pretty decent injury at a motocross track, had an accident with another bike over a jump, ended up with separated shoulder, AC joint, and bruised heart, lung, and internal damage. So his question was, have I had any experience around those injuries and what would be best move going forward? So the AC joint's a pretty simple one. With AC joint, you can have a surgery, but as I understand it, the surgery, for the most part, providing nothing's been like actually, torn or ruptured fully around the AC joint, then the surgery is mostly just for cosmetic. It's to bring that shoulder back into position so it looks a bit better. Like, I blew my AC joint out 20 years ago and never had surgery on it. And if you look at me in a photo with my shirt off, like my right shoulder, even my right pec, like my right nipple is a little bit lower than my left because that whole shoulder is just a tiny bit lower. Doesn't affect me at all. Zero pain in that shoulder now. So surgery is optional on an AC joint. You don't have to have it like any, sort of shoulder injury that doesn't require surgery. It's really just regressing everything back to an accessible level that you can start loading it. So there's like some exercises I use with clients that have had shoulder stuff is starting with isometrics. Like isometrics are going to be the easiest way that you can actually start to load it without it sort of triggering any excessive pain or instability. So obviously having an immovable object to push into, the nervous system, like the brain, can create as much tension. It will feel safe, so it can create as much tension in the muscles around the shoulder as possible. So isometric exercises are really good to incorporate in as a bit of a starting point potentially, and then it really is just about sort of regressing everything back to a level that's accessible and then grading that exposure over time until you get to get back to sort of your normal levels of strength. So the heart and the bruised heart and lung thing, honestly, never had any experience on that. Thankfully, I've never had a client that has had a bruised heart or lung or internal damage like that. So I can't really speak firsthand on that, in all honesty, a little bit out of my scope. My first thought there would be, if your heart has been bruised, then you would want to be like super mindful with cardio activity just in terms of intensity. Like, you're probably not going to be doing any high intensity stuff anyway if you've had a major accident like that. But you'd just want to be wary when you're getting back into training and movement that you're not sort of maxing your heart rate out to like high intensity and putting a lot of stress on your heart. I'd be like starting out super low, like your zone, low zone two, even zone one, like even just going for a walk just to get it working, obviously, without overstressing it. With any injury, really, like circulation is king. Like getting the blood flowing, obviously new fresh blood brings in oxygen, all the nutrients from our food. So is just trying to get moving as much as possible. Like just laying on the couch or laying in bed. That's like sometimes you are bedridden if you've had a serious injury. But as soon as you can get moving, the sooner you can get moving, the better. Even if it is just walking or sitting on an exercise bike or an assault bike or something like that, just getting, even if it's like your heart rate's only getting to like 80 beats a minute, it's like super low intensity. But the overarching premise with any injury, whether it's an acute like shoulder or knee or something more serious like this, it's like getting movement back in, blood flow back in, fresh oxygen, nutrients is going to be a positive thing. So they would be my tips there. Nothing like outstanding there. It's pretty sort of common sense. I'd say that's if you went to like any physio, that's sort of what they'd be recommending, I would say. And that would be another good tip, is like finding a good physio. Like finding a good physio that that deals in sports performance rehab. And that would be like a great place to start to sort of get you moving forward. Next one, riding technique. So this is a great question. I actually coached a few little dudes this morning. So I just got home from coaching three little dudes this morning. So sort of this question kind of popped up today with one of the little guys. So the question is, this gentleman was riding, the way I understand it, riding with a younger guy and they were working on a little bit of technique. So the younger dude was getting a little bit frustrated because he was trying to work or he's working on sort of like his balls of riding on the balls of his feet and where he's and his footwork. Then when he's trying to incorporate other things like working on his attack positions, he'd kind of forget about the balls of the feet or vice versa. Like he couldn't concentrate or couldn't sort of bring the two of them together. One would sort of go out the window. So he's getting a little bit frustrated because he couldn't bring it all together. So when that happens, it's super common. You think about any skill really, like if you're really good at a skill, we can do it at a subconscious level. Like we don't have to think about it. When you're learning something for the very first time, like it requires a lot of focus. So when you are learning new things, and for some people, like changing the foot position on the pegs is a new thing. If you've been riding with your feet pointing out for however many years, even if you're just a young kid and it's only been a few years, it's still like a lot of reps. You've spent a lot of hours riding, especially through that learning phase where it becomes subconscious in a particular position. And then it's like, okay, I'm going to change that now. That requires a lot of focus. So number one, if that is happening, it just simply means you haven't spent enough time on the particular skill to the point that it has become subconscious. If you are practicing a skill, like say the balls of the feet, and then you try and bring in you try and layer another particular thing on top, which in this case is the attack position. And when you layer that, the attack position on top, the balls of the feet goes out the window, then you just haven't spent enough time practicing the balls of the feet for it to become subconscious to the point that you can layer another skill or another movement or another technique on top of it. So when it comes to it's kind of like the chicken and the egg thing. And like, I'll share this little, I just coached three little dudes. Two of them I'd never coached before. And one of them in particular was a younger kid, and he'd never had coaching before. So there's a lot of low-hanging fruit there for him. And like the balls of the feet thing is like a big thing. That's one of my like fundamental things that I get people working on straight away. But he, like, that was almost like, it is like that chicken and the egg thing. Like he had so many other little things that he needed to work on, like where he was sitting on the seat. Like he was sitting so far back on the seat that the front wheel had no weight on it when he was cornering. So he just kept tucking the front like every second corner. Because there was some deep ruts on this track. So my point there is like there was not like me getting him to work on his feet. Like it didn't really matter. It didn't really matter where his feet were because he was sitting so far back on the seat that it, like where his foot was positioned on the peg, like wouldn't have made any difference. So in his case, we actually, I said, look, buddy, forget the feet. We're not even worrying about that today. We've got to get your position on the bike needs to change. We need to get you like right up here on the tank so you're getting some weight on that front wheel. So that was like his main thing for the day, was working on his body position. Once he got that dialed, then we could potentially start to work on his footwork. So that's just like one example how, like, you don't always have to go to the balls of the feet first. It's like, and it is like one of those chicken and the egg things. Like, I sort of believe that the feet does contribute to how the attack position sort of forms, or how we get into our attack positions. I do believe it starts at the feet. So that's why I'm so big on the foot thing. But again, like this little dude wouldn't have mattered like what his feet were doing. So there's no point like ramming that down his throat when we just had to get him like sitting more further forward, get his seated position a lot better. So again, back to this question, in this example, I guess the point I'm trying to get at there is, I think for most people, especially kids, their attack positions, this is where like the off-bike training comes into it. Getting them, like most kids, probably like they have great body awareness on a dirt bike, but then you get them in a gym and it's like, okay, let's do a squat or let's do a hip hinge, and like they can't do it. They're like a fish out of water. So there's a lot of low-hanging fruit there for them, just learning about their body, where their body is in space, spatial awareness, learning these basic movement patterns of squatting and hinging. So if he's, I guess my answer to this question would be, if he's struggling with the attack position part a lot, I'd be trying to work on that away from the bike a bit. Get that dialed in the gym, get that dialed on the bike stand. So doing those drills, I've posted some videos of them, all the other, like there's heaps of other good videos of them out there from all the riding coaches, practicing those attack positions whilst the bike is on the center stand, which you can do like every single night in your garage at home. You don't even have to go for a ride to do it. So getting those dialed in so they do become subconscious. So when he is going out there to ride, like it's a done deal. Like the attack position thing is a done deal. He's not having to think about his attack position per se when he's riding, because that is just subconscious. So you can bring those those attack position, like the body awareness and those positions, you can bring them up to a subconscious level without even having to be on your dirt bike. I feel like that's like, if you can squat and hinge really well and then just practice those little drills in your garage on your dirt bike, going from sitting to standing and moving your body weight forward, then like that's going to lock that in. So then when it comes to practicing it on the bike, we want to eliminate as many variables as possible. So the best way I feel like to lock in the balls of feet and to be able to layer some other things on top of it, like your attack positions, is doing some drills like feet stay on the pegs, leaving the bike in second gear. So what we're doing there is we're eliminating the variables of taking our feet off, and we're eliminating the variables of changing gears. And then we can also do like a no rear brake. So all you're going to do is take off in second gear, you put your feet on the balls of your feet, and then your feet do not move. They do not come off the foot pegs. Your feet stay there. So it just eliminates that variable of the foot having to even move. And then we're just going to ride. You could even just do this on a figure of eight track, just a flat figure of eight track, or even an oval track. You could like really like break it down to the simplest form. Again, remove as many variables as possible. And then we're just working on accelerating, braking, accelerating, braking. So when we accelerate, we're in our attack position. When we're braking, we're driving the hips back. We do not have to take our feet off the foot pegs. So that would be my go-to drill for someone like that. Then again, we're removing those variables, so he doesn't even have to think about his balls of the balls of his feet, because he's not moving his feet. So again, that's going to take a period of time to practice to the point where that becomes subconscious. From there, then we can start to bring in, okay, now you're going to use your rear brake. So we're bringing in a variable. So that variable is now you can use your rear brake. So when you take your foot off and brake, we've got to put it back on the ball. If it goes back to being pointed out on the arch, then we need to spend more time working on that skill. And the same with the gears. Once we start bringing the gear changes in, taking the feet off to go around turns, then we're layering on other elements, other variables there. So it's just, most people get frustrated because they try and progress too quickly. They don't want to spend enough hours practicing on like the simplest things. They just want to try and go fast all the time. So if that's, I guess, how I would come at that. I'd be like breaking it down, removing those variables, and then just what that could actually look like is just every time you go for a ride is just spending doing a warm-up moto, 15 minutes. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do 15 minutes as a warm-up moto with my feet on the pegs with the bike in second gear, no rear brake. That's all I'm going to do is just ride around this track, keep my feet on the pegs. Over time, if you do that every single time you go out riding, before long, like, well, I shouldn't say before long, it will take a long time, but you get my point. Like, you practice that enough times every time you go for a ride, it will become subconscious at some point. It's just going to take repetition. So next question, a little bit of a nutrition one. Multi-day rallies, spending 8+ hours a day on the bike for multiple days back to back. What would be my recommendations for nutrition, sort of both on and off the bike in that situation? So the general rule of thumb we use for hydration is per hour, 300 calories, which is 75 grams of carbs and 1,000 milligrams of sodium. The amount of fluid will vary depending on the heat and the sweat rate, but it's going to be somewhere between, on the low end, 600 mil, on the high end, a liter per hour. Now, that is for a race intensity. That is for someone that's racing a 3-hour cross country. They're our sort of our per hour metrics that we use as a bit of a guide. Some people are going to be above that. Some people are going to be a little bit under, but that's our sort of bandwidth where we start to build our nutrition strategy for the race. So a rally, obviously, it's not 8 hours, Matt. You're not spending 8 hours with your heart rate on 180. So it's probably not going to be those figures for 8 hours, but there might be a special stage in there that takes 3 hours. So for that particular part of the special stage, you might want to be hitting those numbers. And then where you have liaison stages, potentially where it's just transport, you're just cruising down a road at 100K an hour, or whatever that looks like, then you might not be taking in as much. So it's going to be different for every event, I would say. It depends on the event, how it's structured, how much special stage there is, how much liaison stage there is. But that just gives you, I guess, somewhere to start and then sort of build your strategy from that. Then you're probably not going to be able to carry like everything you need for the entire day in one hydration pack. So what you're going to, ideally, you're going to want to take more hydration powder with carbs and electrolytes in it. So whenever you get to a fuel stop or a checkpoint or whatever that looks like, you can get some, hopefully you can get access to some extra water to be able to refill your hydration pack and add more carbs, electrolytes in, etc. Most hydration packs are around 2 to 3 liters. That's probably, like, even a 3-liter one is not going to be enough for an 8 to 12 hour day on the bike. So you're going like to have to find a way to be able to refill that, ideally in a perfect situation. And then I'd be looking at like carrying extra hydration fuel with carbs and electrolytes in it, I'd definitely be carrying protein powder. So in those situations, that's the biggest battle you face. You're spending so long on the bike, like 8 to 12 hours, your eating window is compressed. Like, you can ideally eat a massive breakfast and then you can eat a massive dinner at the end of the day, ideally. But you've got this big window, like it could be 12 hours through the middle there, where like you're not going to sit down to steak and three veg. So you've got to have some options there that you can get in whilst you're on the bike, basically, or at a refuel or a checkpoint. So like your protein powders, your carb powders, definitely be carrying extra of them. So if you get to a fuel stop and you can get a bottle of water and chuck a serving of protein into that, or a scoop or two of protein, you're getting some protein through your day. Then you've got your things like Clif bars or protein bars, things like that. Definitely would want to be carrying some of those. I don't know, like there's a ton of brands. I don't, obviously, honestly don't use them that much. So I couldn't, there's no brands that I could really recommend, like any of that thing. It's really just experimenting. Some people like a particular brand, some people hate them. So you'd really have to just buy a few and test them, see what you like. In those situations, like you want to be like trying to find options that are easy to get down. That's the biggest thing I hear from like my clients and people in these situations, is they're like, oh, I thought this would be a great idea to eat, but then I got to the pit stop or the fuel stop or whatever it is, and I was like, I was in such a rush. I only had 2 minutes to fuel my bike, and I'm trying to eat this thing, trying to get it down, trying to chew it up. My mouth was dry, and it's like I could only eat like a quarter of it because I just couldn't get it down. So it's sort of, again, it's a bit of a trial by fire thing. You're not going to figure that out until you test it. So, but just be aware of that if you are in a rush at a fuel stop, your mouth's dry, you've had a big day, like, is this going to be easy or palatable for me to get down? Like, when you get into these situations, it's, your nutrition is a means to an end. It's not going to be the perfect, clean paleo diet with no processed foods. It's almost impossible to be able to do that in these situations. So you almost got to take what you can get to an extent. But again, it's only for 7 days. And then when you get home, you go back to eating the way you normally eat. So I know one of my clients who has raced a ton of these rallies and he's actually competed in Dakar, what he does is gets those dehydrated meals, like what you would have when you go on a hike. Now, he's obviously not carrying these on the bike with him, but he has these back at his camper at the pits. Because potentially some of these events, if you're having to eat at the bivouac, the food that they provide you is not great. When I say not great, it's like you're probably going to be fine getting a ton of carbs. There's normally lots of breads, pastas, things like this, but there's very low protein from what I understand. And the servings are quite small. So he takes these meals. All you got to do is add water to them. They're high calorie, like 700-800 calories, and they've got a good balance of protein, carbs, and fats in them. All you got to do is add hot water, and you know you're getting 800 calories. Is it going to be the best tasting meal you've ever had in your life? Probably not. Would you want to eat one every night of the week? Probably not. But in that situation, when you're doing like 7-12-hour days back-to-back on the bike, like you really just need to be getting calories in. The big risk there is under-eating and not getting enough calories in, and then you're going to fall in a hole like day 3, 4, 5 or whatever it might be towards the end once you start doing back-to-back days. If you're not getting enough calories in and enough protein for recovery, like you're really going to feel that on the back end of the race. So it's just having some of those options available to you that are going to be convenient and easy to get in that situation. So he also asked, should I mix everything in my hydration pack, like the carbs, the electrolytes, and the protein in the hydration pack? My short answer there would be no. I've put BCAAs in my Camelback once, and it was a disaster because it starts to, the amino acids, the protein can actually ferment in there. If you've ever had that experience of leaving a protein shaker on the sink with the lid sealed and you forget about it, or you leave it in your car for a few days, if you ever opened one of them, it's like, it's bad. So you don't want that going on in your hydration pack. So my advice there would be keep the protein separate. If you can carry the protein powder in a little sachet in your hydration pack, in the backpack, so when you get to a pit stop, you can hopefully get a bottle of water or something like that, and drop it in, shake it up, drink it that way. That would be my advice. I wouldn't personally be putting protein into a hydration pack. I'd definitely be keeping that separate and just trying to get a few servings in across your day in bottles of water. So, next question was, how do I keep my mind in the game all year, and is it okay to have a week off the bike every now and then if you're feeling like you're a bit over it? So I would definitely, the short answer to that one is yes, definitely. Like, again, I don't know your situation, but if you're just like a recreational racer, even like some of my pro clients, like, definitely take time off the bike through the year. Like, they're not banging motos every single week, 52 weeks of the year. There is periods of time where they ride a lot less. So when it comes to training, like, I put a little bit of a screenshot up on my Instagram story yesterday. When it comes to training, I like physical training and fitness, I think like being in tune with what your reason why is, like the reason why you want to train, the reason why you want to be fit, healthy, strong, etc., is super important. If it's not to say that there's anything wrong with having the goal of training for a race, but if there's a race on in 12 weeks time and you're like, I'm going all in, I'm training for this race, and then once the race is over, you're just like, oh, the race is done now, don't have to train, like, it's going back to the couch, then that means those habits that you've created are not really going to stick if you're relying on a race for motivation. So when it comes to off bike stuff and just training in general, fitness in general, you got to have a reason why. And if that reason why is something other than a race that's at a particular time from now, a point in time on the calendar, then there's like it's going to be a lot better chance that those habits that you're going to create around training, nutrition, your health are going to stick for a longer period of time, because then the training becomes not about a race. Like, the race is just like this little part of the process along the way. The overarching reason why you're doing it is much greater than that. So it's a lot easier to stay motivated in that situation. When it comes to riding our dirt bike, I would say, like I said, it's definitely fine to have some time off the bike, but just be aware of why is that? That would be my question. I've definitely experienced this, like I've mentioned on this podcast plenty of times before. Like, I actually sold all my dirt bikes 10 years ago and never wanted to ride one again. And the reason that happened is because I had so much stress going on in all other areas of my life that it was taking my focus away from just enjoying riding my dirt bike. So now I'm aware of that. So, like, honestly, that does happen to me sometimes too. Like, sometimes I don't enjoy riding my dirt bike as much now. And when that happens, it's because I've got a bit too much stuff going on and it's taking my focus away from actually being present on the dirt bike and just enjoying it for what it is, just enjoying riding the dirt bike. So that would be, I guess, my advice there would be, if you feel like you need to take some time away from the bike, just, that's totally fine, but just be aware of that. Why is that? Why do I want to take this time away from the bike? If it's just because you need a rest from riding, that's fine. But if there's something else underlying there, that's causing it, if there's a root cause, we want to address that root cause. Because if you think about, like, when you're like having, when you've got like a low level of stress in your life and you every time you go out on the bike, you just, you're having the best time of your life. Like, you feel like you're progressing, you feel like you're riding awesome. That's like, you want to try and remind yourself of that. Like, what are the other factors that are going on in your life that allow you to cultivate that experience? Not to say that it's not going to fluctuate, because it is, but I'm just saying that it's good to be aware of why, like 6 months ago when I was loving it, like, what was I doing? Why was I loving it so much? Why was it so much fun to go out riding there? And then if you can be aware of those things, just setting yourself up for success. Like, if you know you're going to go to some beat up track that hasn't had rain for 3 months, like, don't go. Don't put yourself in that situation where, if you're not enjoying riding, like, don't go to some shitty track that you know is going to suck, because you're not going to have a good time. You're going to come away from that, and all it's going to do is reinforce the fact that you're not enjoying riding right now. So again, like, set yourself up for success. So if you have a track that you know every time you go there, it's like the best day you've ever had on a dirt bike, go to that track. Go riding there. Put yourself in those situations where you know that you're going to have a good day on the bike. So you, again, it's like setting yourself up for success. They would be my tips there. This next one is about Garmin, just the Garmin watch. And what activities should I use to track? Like, which setting should I use? This is actually a really good question. I used to have a 935 Forerunner Garmin. Awesome watch. It had like basically every activity, which, if anyone's got like a Garmin Fenix, they're very similar. Like, any activity you could think of, basically, except motocross. I think some of the new Garmins actually do have motocross potentially, but anyway, there's like everything: walking, cross country, skiing, like anything you can think of is in there as an activity. And you can also create your own custom activities. So you can add in, like, you can actually add in moto. So I had motos in there. I had trail riding. I had mobility workout. I had my custom profiles in there of activities. So anyway, that Garmin, when I crashed last year, blew the thing off the handlebars, lost it, had to buy a new one. So I thought, oh, well, screw it. I'll just get a cheap one this time. I thought, well, like, it doesn't matter. Like, I don't need all those features. I'll just get like a $300 one that was on special. So I got like a 255. And honestly, I regret it, because that's one of the biggest things with it, is it only has like three or four activities in there. It has running, cycling, walking, and cardio. They're the main activities. Excuse me. So you're very limited. So when, and not that that matters, like, basically, really, like, when you're tracking, unless you're going running, running obviously tracks your average pace whilst you're running. But for most activities that we do, like, really, you just want to see your heart rate. And any of the activities will do that. Any of the activities will obviously track your heart rate enough that you can go in there and you can view the data and get some feedback off it. So it's basically, you can get what you need to get from any activity, really. The downside to that is when you go into your Garmin dashboard, it just says other, 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 or cardio, cardio, cardio. Obviously, if it's a run or cycling, you've got those there. What I really liked about the Forerunner is when I did a session on the rower, it had rowing. So I didn't have to go in there and edit any of the activities, the names of them. Like, I could go back to 6 months ago in October last year and be like, okay, this was a strength session, this was a rowing session, this was a mountain bike, this was a dirt bike ride. Whereas now with this cheap one, it's like everything's just, it's either it's cycling, or the other one I use for when I go on my motos, and my cardio is other. So I've got like all these cycling activities in there and all these other activities in there in my Garmin dashboard. So that's a bit frustrating. And honestly, if I had my time again, I would have just coughed up the extra $600 or so and got a Fenix. And honestly, I probably will very soon, because I'm regretting the decision of buying a cheap Garmin. But again, to answer this question, it honestly doesn't matter that much if you just want to get your heart rate. If you're going out for a moto on your dirt bike and you just want to see what your heart rate's doing, then like honestly, any activity that you choose in your Garmin will be completely fine for that. But yeah, if you're in the market for a Garmin, I would say definitely if you can afford a few extra $100, it's definitely worth it to get a 945 or a Fenix. Any of the Fenix models are awesome too. Last question. Improving muscular endurance for hard enduro. So this one came off the email list. So this particular gentleman mentioned that he's been training consistently for 6 months, sort of came off the couch before that and has been training consistently for 6 months. Noticed some massive benefits at the start to his riding and in hard enduro races, but he's kind of feels like he's sort of plateaued a little bit now, and he's feeling like his muscular endurance is sort of holding him back at the end of some of these races. So I did probe in a little bit deeper into this question to sort of get an idea of what he's actually doing for his training, like what he has been doing. And just firstly, like if you're listening, the gentleman that's sending this question, like give yourself a pat on the back. Like if you've come off the couch and completed 6 months of consistent training, like honestly, give yourself a pat on the back, because not that many people can actually do that. So definitely give yourself a pat on the back for that, man, because it's a pretty big thing to be able to like go from not training and stay consistent for 6 months is awesome. So keep up the good work. What I would say is, after probing into this a little bit more, the gentleman sent back a reply that said he's doing 16 working sets, two gym days a week that are full body gym sessions, 16 working sets per muscle group per week is what he's doing. So I could be completely wrong here, but reading between the lines, if you're sort of adding up the working sets you're doing, and by the way, that's quite a bit of volume per muscle group. Like I don't think many of my clients would be doing that much volume, like per like 16 working sets for their quads as an example. But again, like reading between the lines, what that sounds like, if you're measuring the working sets you're doing per muscle group per week, that kind of would lead me to think that you're doing a bit more of a bodybuilder split. Although you said that you're training full body sessions, what that would sort of lead me to think is that you're doing more of like isolation type exercises. So leg press, leg extension, lat pull down, tricep extension, so on and so forth, if you're adding up the working sets you're doing per muscle group. So my advice there would be think, like forget the sets per muscle group. Don't worry about per muscle group. Think about movements, not muscle groups. So how we break it down, or how I break it down for my clients, is knee dominant movements and hip dominant movements for the lower body. So our knee dominant movements are any sort of squat, lunge, split squat variation, even like leg press, leg extension, they're going in your knee dominant exercises. Your hip dominant is more of like your deadlifts, RDLs, Harrop curls, hip thrusts even is a hip dominant, even a back extension is more of an isolation type. You get my point. It's like more of your hip hinging posterior chain exercises are your hip dominant exercises. And then of course we've got our upper body, which is just push pull, horizontal and vertical. So horizontal is sort of off our chest, vertical up and down. Think about looking at your workouts more like that. Break your workouts, not necessarily break them down, but look at your balance of training per week. Is it balanced between knee dominant and hip dominant for the lower body, and for the upper body, horizontal and vertical push-pull patterns. Have I got a good balance of that? Don't worry about the working sets. Look at how your training is balanced across your workouts in that way. Knee dominant, hip dominant, upper body, push-pull. And then you've obviously got some, we also have some core exercises in there as well, obviously. The core training kind of just fits into its own little category. It's not really hip dominant or knee dominant. They're just sort of added in into some of the accessory work, the core exercises. So that would be my biggest tip there in terms of the strength training. If you feel like, because again, like I obviously don't know what you're doing. If you're feeling like muscular endurance is an issue for you, and the red flag for me there would be if you're doing sort of more of your isolation type exercises, bodybuilding type exercises, then not to say that they're bad exercises, but especially when you're only spending 2 days a week in the gym, like 2 days a week is great. You can get really strong training 2 days a week in the gym, but you're gonna have to cut a lot of the fluff out. You really just need to focus on your big rocks, and your big rocks are compound movements with free weights. So squatting, hinging, and your upper body push pull with free weights, and obviously getting your core strength in there as well. So when you train 3 days a week, you got a little bit more space there. You got a whole other day that you can potentially bring some more of that isolation type stuff in, depending on what your weaknesses are or your goals are. When you're only doing 2 days a week, you do limit yourself a little bit. Again, not to say you can't make great progress on 2 days a week. I have plenty of clients that make great progress 2 days a week. Like I say, you just got to cut the fluff and focus on the big rocks. So that would be my biggest tip on the strength side. And then he also mentioned that he's doing 2 days of cardio training, one sort of lower base training, one higher intensity, which is great, by the way. It's good to break it up like that. So my tip there would be, can you get some more aerobic base volume in across your week? And again, this is something I've mentioned on the podcast before, but most people think because they can't get out for 60 minutes at a time or a 90-minute bike ride that it's not worth doing. And that's just not true. If you're getting 2 days a week of like with a longer proper session, and then every other day you can get 20 minutes on a spin bike or 20 minutes on a treadmill or whatever that looks like, if you've got some option, or just going for a jog, if you're into running, I don't know. My point there is, if you can just find some other way to dose some low intensity cardio more frequently across your week, even if it's only 15, 20 minutes at a time, that means each week you're going to potentially accumulate an extra hour or an extra hour and a half of aerobic base training. Like zone 2 aerobic base training is very, it's not taxing, so it's not going to really, like just adding that much in, like a few 3 or 4 20-minute efforts a week, it's not going to like bring a heap of extra fatigue in, especially when it's broken down to short efforts like that. Like you'd barely notice it from a fatigue sense, but it will contribute to improving your aerobic capacity over time. So that would be my tip there, would be trying to figure out a way, even if it's only twice a week. If you get your 2 days where you do your longer session, then 2 other days you get 20 minutes. Like it all counts. That's I harp on about that to all of my clients all of the time, is it all counts. If you can get 15, 20, 30 minutes here, there, all of that volume just compounds over time. It's like compounding interest. So I'd be looking at trying to figure out some ways that you can get some extra base training in. And then just consider that it's probably going to take a little bit longer too, because like I said at the start, definitely give yourself a pat on the back for training consistently for 6 months. When you come off the couch and you start training, you're going to notice like this, your progress is just going to go through the roof. Basically for those first 2 to 3 months, you're going to feel like Superman. Like you're going to be like, God, everything in life is just getting easier. I'm getting better, getting faster, riding my dirt bike's getting easier. that's pretty normal for someone that has an exercise to start training. They're going to feel like these massive benefit for the first few months, and then you're going to start to plateau. Like this gentleman said, he's only got sort of 4 days a week that he can commit to training off the bike, and then one day on the bike. So he's kind of capped out at that amount of volume. So he's doing that amount of volume and he's been doing it for 6 months. So at the start, there's going to be this big ramp up of progress, and then you're going to start to plateau. So everyone's going to have this sort of threshold that they get to of the amount of time that they can commit to training and how long they can do it for. So there's basically two ways to speed up progression. One is to train more volume each week, but again, everyone's kind of capped out. The second one is just wait longer. Keep doing it consistently and just wait longer. It's going to take more time than 6 months. And the more you get into your fitness journey, the slower the gains come. It's going to take another 12 months of consistency to experience that level of progress that you experienced in the first 3 months. Like literally, it's going to take longer and longer and longer. Hopefully that doesn't put you off training. It does take a longer period of time. So if you are capped out at the amount of training, or the amount of time you can commit to training each week, then the only other option you have got left is just wait longer. Just stay consistent, keep stacking those bricks, compounding interest week after week, month after month, year on year, and you will get better over time. So that is it for today. Hope you all got some value out of those questions. If you did and you want to share the podcast, that'd be awesome. I'd be super grateful for that. Otherwise, we will see you next month for the next listener Q&A episode. Again, thank you to everyone that's sending questions. I appreciate you. The podcast, the listener Q&A podcast wouldn't be a thing if you guys didn't send in questions. So thank you very much for doing that. And we will see you on the next episode. Bye-bye.